Ladies and gentlemen, we are here for the return of Browner and Bert. I know that sounds crazy, but we had to take off last week because other shows had vacations, and so then there needed to be things moved around, and other people had to do things. But we are back, and not only are we back, we're back with a bomb guest who we will introduce in a second. But I'm John Browner. You see on the screen right there, Bert Grossman. You will hear his voice soon. We are known as Browner and Bert, coming to you right here on the Mightier 1090 at 6 p.m. You can hear us from the border all the way past Los Angeles. Some call it Santa Barbara. I call it Santa Barbara Beautiful. It is what it is, though. You can find Bert on Twitter at Bert _. You can find me at Browner's Podcast on Twitter and as well as on Instagram. And Bert is old, so he is also on Facebook at Bert Grossman. So have fun with that. Do what you want with it. We have a guest on the show. You guys know me. I'm a huge Bears fan, and I talk Bears all the time. Bert talks about being a great white sack leader for the San Diego Chargers. He can talk people to come on this show. I don't know how he does it, but he does. And we've talked one of my favorite quarterbacks. Well, he's really the only other quarterback we've ever had.
Yeah, he's
in the Chicago Bear history to come on this show, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only.
Oh no,
what? Cordell Stewart? No, Jim McMahon. Jim McMahon. Jim McMahon joins us. Quarterback of the 1985 Chicago Bears, one called the greatest defense in history. But we won't really gloss over any of that. Or we're gonna have fun with him. We're going to have conversations with him because him and Bert were busy this weekend. We definitely going to hear about that. But ladies and gentlemen, welcome Jim McMahon to the show. How's it going, Jim?
How's it going, guys? I'm doing great. Thanks.
You look relaxed today, Jim.
I'm very relaxed. Yeah. just had a little breakfast not long ago and just about to start my day.
So you've had one of the more famous careers as a quarterback in the history of the league in the history of the NFL. What do you do now? Like what happens in Jim McMahon's life now?
Well, as you mentioned over the weekend, we just launched our new cannabis brand called Revenant. Myself, Kyle Turley, Ricky Williams, Evan Britton, are the ball players involved in this company as of now. And so hopefully getting a lot of work doing that. I'm also involved in a CBD infused K-tape company, which is hopefully that's
oh, nice.
That stuff actually works. I called them up as soon as I tried it and I said, hey, how do I get involved with this company? It was amazing what it did. So hopefully you know, these two things will take off and I can do some more relaxing. I kind of enjoy that more than anything.
Hey, I remember, you played in the brutal times. And when you got out, I mean, you had so many injuries. What were you like? What was your pain pill thing? Did you get hooked on those? And then did you replace that with the cannabis or how'd that come about?
Oh yeah. I was eating painkillers, you know, throughout my whole career. And I think about 5 years after my career, I was still eating them. I knew I had to get off of them. You know, they're not good for your head or your body, your bodily functions. And, I've always been an advocate for cannabis and, that's all I've used since I think it was 2002. I haven't had a painkiller, an aspirin, anything else other than cannabis to help me function.
You didn't smoke weed at BYU?
On the underground. Yeah.
So how'd you get to BYU? Because one of the questions we always ask our guests, because Bert's got such a great college stories and great history collegiately with a bunch of guys who've been on the show, is when you went on your visits, what was the worst school you visited? Because that we usually get a good story out of that.
Oh wow, the worst school. I mean, I went back to Nebraska, Oklahoma State, went up to Boise because I'd never been to Idaho. All the Utah schools.
But what was the worst one? What school did you go to?
I'm trying to think which, you know, BYU might have been the worst one because I almost broke my damn legs up. They took us up skiing, and I'd never been skiing before. I grew up in San Jose, and, I played in a little bit of snow my last 2 years of high school up in Utah, but I'd never skied. And damn near broke my leg. So I wasn't real happy with that. And my last trip, was Vegas. And all I ever wanted to do was play baseball. That was my that was my love. So I wanted to be able to play both sports. And of all the schools that I went to, the only two that said I could play both was BYU and Nevada, Las Vegas. And so, I came home from Vegas and I said, "Pops, I'm going to Vegas." And he said, "No, you're not. It's not a big this and that." And I said, "Pops, listen to me. I just got offered a house, car, money, easy job at the casino. I mean, hell, who knows what could have happened? I would have been a millionaire before I left school. That's for damn sure."
So you were on the Burt train, because Burt said he got offered a gang of stuff too to go to certain schools, and he, for whatever reason, turned it all down and went to Pitt.
Pitt was good back then, man. What are you talking about?
Well, now at least these guys are going to start making money in college, I hear now. So,
yeah, what do you think about that? I mean, you get places like Alabama. I mean, it's almost like the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. I mean, how does like a school like San Diego State or BYU compete against, like, you know, Alabama, or come out there, Texas, and be like, "Hey, our alumni has a $2 billion company and we're going to pay every guy this much money to be a spokesperson"? How do you, I mean, it's legalized paying now. I mean, how do you compete with the bigger schools and with the big alumni that can put up that cash now?
Well, it's going to be just like it's always been. You know, the schools with the money are going to get the players.
And that's SMU.
The way it's, you know, it's always, SMU, you know, they had the best team money could buy back in the day. No, it's always going to be, there's always going to be somebody, you know, that's going to get paid a little bit more than somebody else. And then somebody's going to bitch about it. And then, you know, there'll be crackdowns. But, you know, it's happened from day one. And I'm sure now that they're going to get paid legally, I'm sure some guys will still get more on the side as well.
So when you were telling your dad, "Hey, listen, I'm going to Las Vegas, they're giving me all this stuff. What's the problem?" Why was he so adamant on BYU?
I think he thought, he didn't think Vegas had a big enough program to where I would get to the next level. I think that was his concern. And I said, "Pops, I'm not worried about that. You know, I knew I was good enough to play on the next level, but I said, I wanted to have some fun as well in college. You know, I sit and listen to some of these guys' old college stories, and you know, I got nothing to contribute. You know, we didn't have, we had girls' dorms on one side of the quad, guys on the other. You know, I was only in the dorms 1 year, thank God. And then I kind of moved around Provo and Orem for the next 4 years.
But guys hold true to that? Like, guys literally don't – there's no sex on the campus at BYU. None?
Oh, no. It does happen. But
okay.
It's frowned upon like everything else was. You know, caffeine, tobacco. You know, some of the things were so hypocritical. Like, you know, they used to – we were big guinea pigs for DMSO back in the day. It was like a horse liniment, you know, and they didn't know how much to put on you. So they would soak leaf tobacco with this DMSO, and they put it on whatever contusion you had. You know, a lot of guys got third degree burns from this stuff. But I mean, the tobacco was going right into your system, but yet you couldn't chew the tobacco. I couldn't figure that one out.
I went there
right into my bloodstream, but yet I can't have a dip. I couldn't figure one. That was one of the ones that kind of freaked me out. Go ahead, Bert.
We went and played there, I think, 86 or 7 from Pitt, and I was in shock. I mean, we pulled in there, and Pitt's a city school, you know, probably in not the best part of town. And we went there, and it was like one of those Star Trek episodes where everybody's blonde. and like everything's perfect. There's no crime. You go into like a store, you can't buy liquor. There's no porn magazines. There's no tobacco. I mean, it was just a crazy, crazy place. I mean, it was literally off like an old William Shatner Star Trek where he lands at like Perfect Land or something.
Well, now you know how I felt when I first moved there. When I was a junior in high school, when my dad's job moved him up to Utah. And, you know, I grew up with the Brothers and the Mexicans in San Jose. And I couldn't find a brother in a Mexican in rural Utah.
Yeah. So when you make that switch, when you make, because that's a culture shock.
Oh.
When I moved from Chicago to San Diego, the high school I went to, there was literally 8 black kids there, and I was like, "Well, wait a minute." And I went to a high school in Chicago where there were no white kids, there were no Mexican kids. It was literally just black kids. And so when you go from the Bay to Utah, what was that culture shock like as a young man?
It was quite devastating. You know, I was 16 years old. I'm like, "Wow, what am I going to do here?" And then, you know, my dad had been there a month or so before we got there, and I didn't get there till late in the training camp. because I was playing in a traveling baseball team in California. And so they'd already started training camp, and I knew they had two senior quarterbacks. One guy was actually 6'10".
Quarterback?
He was a javelin thrower and a pitcher in baseball, but 6'10", and we're running the veer. You know, I'd only seen that on television. Only Texas and Oklahoma used to run that back then. And because all we did in California was throw the ball. And so I sat there. I didn't even go to practice. I sat in the parking lot, watched the first day. And I got home. My dad said, "Well, how'd it go?" And I said, "Well, if I can't play here, I can't play. But they run the veer." I'm like, I don't want to be, faking the ball to the fullback, pitching it, and then getting drilled by the defensive end. That's no fun. But luckily, I had a really fast halfback, white kid. It was a legit 4-3 guy. I mean, get him the ball and he's gone. But that wasn't a whole lot of fun. They changed it my senior year. I got to throw it a little bit more. We changed to two-back offense, and at least I got to throw a little bit more. But right out of the gate was not a whole lot of fun. And that's basically when I started chewing tobacco. You know, I'd been there a couple weeks, and I'm sitting around with a couple of my teammates, and I'm like, "Hey, what do you guys do here for a buzz?" You know, I said, "I grew up kind of, smoking pot and sniffing glue and stuff. What do you guys do here?" And the guy gave me this Copenhagen stuff, right? And I said, "What do you do with this?" He told me, and I threw it in there, and I'm swallowing it, eating it. You know, I'm like,
"Oh,"
I'm like, "Hey guys, this stuff tastes like shit. I mean, what'd you give me?" They go, "You're not eating it, are you?" I said, "Well, what am I supposed to be doing?" They said, "Well, you spit it every once in a while." I'm like, "Oh, okay," but I never got sick. And I got a little buzz on it, and that was 46 years ago, and I'm still doing it. So,
hey, let me ask you a question, man, because everybody, the 85 Bears, everybody says greatest team. I mean, every list is greatest team ever to play. Why was the greatest team ever assembled one and done, do you think, as far as the Super Bowl is concerned?
Well, that's the big, knock on our team. I mean, it wasn't like we went away. You know, the year we won it, we were 15-1. The next year we went 14-2. We had home field advantage. The next year was a strike year. We still had home field advantage that year. My last year there in 88, I think we were 12-4, had the best record in the league again. We just kept screwing up at home in the playoffs. I mean, that's, you work all year to get that home field advantage, and then you just piss it away at home. You know, that just kind of sucked. But that was a damn good football team for about five straight years. We went to the playoffs and had a chance every year.
Yeah, being from Pitt, I'm sorry, John. Being from Pitt, I was a big Dicka fan. But it always stuck me wrong, like in the Super Bowl, that when they were close down there, he'd give it to the fridge instead of Walter Payton to score a touchdown in the Super Bowl. Was that an issue, or is that just fans thinking that's an issue?
Well, Walter was very upset about it as well, but I've talked a lot about this subject. Walter never said a word to me about it during that game. After that game, I played with him two more years after that. But talking to his son later, these later years, and also Matt Suey, who was our fullback, he said, yeah, he was really, really upset about it. And I said, why? I mean, the New England's whole focus was stop Walter Payton and we win. And they did a damn good job of that. I mean, he carried the ball, I think, 27 times in the game. I mean, and we gave it to him down on the goal line. But, I mean, I tell people, watch the first play of the second half. We're backed up on our 4-yard line, and we run a play-action pass. And it wasn't even a good fake to Walter. And there's six guys chasing him. And Willie was running up the middle of the field, one more yard. If I throw it one more yard, it's 96-yard touchdown. But that's the kind of influence he had on the game. Everybody else was able to do what they did because of their focus on Walter. I think we could have gave it to him 100 times, and he probably wouldn't have got in because that was their focus.
I think what you're saying is 100% correct. Like, they did not want him to score. So the idea would just be, all right, he won't score, but everybody else will, and that's why they got the doors blown off of them. I think a lot of people lose focus on that when they talk about Fridge scoring and Walter not scoring. And I think another thing that Bert mentioned about the 85 Bears and what happened after that team for like the next 4 or 5 years, they were still a good team. It's hard to win the Super Bowl. It's hard to win the Super Bowl. And so the fact that you guys got there and you won it in the fashion that you did, and you brought a lot of that good defense back and added to it in certain points as well, I think people were just – expecting you to continue to win because you were so good and the expectations became so high. And that team became like a caricature, really, because they had a song, they had a dance.
Oh, yeah, do the dance for us. Do the dance. Do the Super Bowl song.
I didn't want to do it then. I ain't doing it now.
Please don't do it now. Please don't do it now.
Tanya played it like 20 times last night. What are you talking about?
Yeah, like I said, it wasn't like we went away. We were right there every year. We just did not have good days in the playoffs. There, you know, we don't have a five-game or seven-game playoff schedule. You're one and done. And unfortunately, we were done after the ones.
What was it like for you in the city when you got after you guys won? Or you know what? Better than that, up to when you were on the road to the Super Bowl. What was it like being around the city for you and for guys around the team?
Oh, it was great. I mean, that's a bear town. You know, the Bulls won six championships, and everybody was excited. But you know, it's nothing like when the Bears win. And they're very knowledgeable fans. You know, all they got to do in Chicago for them to like you is you play hard. And they understand the game, and they know people that play hard. So they'll like it. And then if you play hard and you win, they'll just love you forever. And it's, you know, that was 36 years ago that we won. And, you know, they would still rather us kind of hang around the city than what's going on there now.
It's always 1985 in Chicago. Hey, so – everybody remembers the defense, and we remember Buddy Ryan. Was Dicka the offensive coordinator then? Was he calling plays?
That wasn't his title, but yeah, he was. He'd be calling. Yeah, he was. He was not a coordinator. That's for damn sure.
But he would call plays.
Oh yeah, he'd call them. And
how often?
And like, I wouldn't.
Out of 10 of his calls, how many would you audible out of?
It depends. You know, it would depend on the situation. It depend on how I felt, what was going on in the game. You know, he was a tight end. He was a hell of a tight end. I wish I could have played with the guy. He was a great football player, but he was not a good play caller. And he would send stuff in sometimes. I'd look over and I'd pretend I couldn't hear him in the helmet. And he'd be cussing me out. I know you can hear me. And I'd say, no, we ain't running that right here. We're going to do this. Or I would just get up to the line of scrimmage, and sometimes I'd change him. Sometimes I wouldn't. You know, I didn't always change his runs to a pass. Sometimes I changed them to different runs. It all depended on, you know, what I saw on the defense. And he would get up.
I remember
when they worked.
When Mike McCoy came here from Denver, that was, and I remember bringing it up at the time, and nobody really listened. I mean, if you don't play, you don't really know what goes on the field. But, you know, everybody thought he's this great offense coordinator because he just won the Super Bowl. But people didn't realize Peyton Manning audibled out of 95% of his plays at the line. So Peyton Manning was the offense coordinator. And then he got here and he couldn't call a game, and he hasn't had a job calling one since. People don't realize the quarterbacks actually are the offense coordinators, pretty much.
Well, they should understand what the hell the game's going. You know, you get a big old thick game plan every week. You know, of all the defense's tendencies for the last, what, four or five games, I can't remember how many games they go back. You know, if you just do your homework, just glance at that a little bit and watch a little bit of film, you know, they're not going to change drastically from week to week. You know, defenses might try to put in one or two little wrinkles, but for the most part, it's you know, they'll go right back to the basics after the first series or two. So, you know, just if you do your homework, if you're not, you know, knowledge is confidence. If you know what the hell they're doing and you know what the hell you're doing, it's pretty easy. It's pretty easy game.
So when you were in the huddle, in that Bears huddle, we'll talk about in the second half. We're going to go to commercial. We got about a minute. When we come back, we'll talk about what you did here in San Diego, because you had a great year for the San Diego Chargers as well. When you're in the huddle and you see Walter Payton, you see all these other good offensive players, did you guys ever feel overshadowed by the defense?
No. It was, you know, we knew what our role was. I mean, our role was to control the football, put points on the board, and then let them go to work. And, you know, we led the league in rushing four straight years. I don't think that's ever been done before or since then. And that's a credit to those guys up front, because – you know, they know we're going to run. And if we're still able to run when you guys know that's a pretty good offensive line. And they really didn't get a hell of a lot of credit other than Jimbo Covert finally is going in the Hall of Fame this year. I know there's at least two other guys that should be going in, maybe a third as well. So, but, you know, you never know. But we didn't feel overshadowed at all. We just said, let them get all the credit, but we know over here who's winning the games.
You're listening to Jim McMahon right here on Burt and Browner, or Browner and Burt, depending on how you like to listen to us. Some people want to put his name first, but that's never going to happen because he doesn't do any other work. So when we come back, we get to the second half of the podcast. We'll talk about Jim McMahon's career here locally in San Diego. We'll have some fun with him because, you know, Burt's probably got some stories that him and Jim can share. And we're going to talk about some weed. We're definitely going to talk about weed when we come back. I'm John Browner, Burt Grossman. Jim McMahon's with us, Brown and Burt, the Mighty 1090. Second half of the podcast. John Browner, Burt Grossman, Browner and Burt here on the Mighty 1090. As always, you can find us on YouTube as well. Hey, Burt, guess what's happening today?
The Milwaukee?
No, it's tomorrow. No. We're available on podcast now.
Oh, wow. All right. Hey, you know what? I have a question because you brought up the gym in San Diego and he brought up a story I forgot about Saturday when we were hanging out about Courtney Hall. Man, tell that story. Because these are the things you see. Like, you watch on TV and you don't realize what's going on. This is a prime example of what goes on.
Can I tell this on this show?
Yeah, you can tell. You just got to. Yeah, you can tell the story.
Okay. Well, it's going to be Courtney's first start. I don't remember who we're playing against. But he's also on the kickoff return team.
Okay, but for the people who don't know, explain who Courtney is.
Oh, Courtney Hall was a center in the league for quite a few years. Damn good center.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This was his rookie year, and he was going to get his first start, but he's also on the kickoff return team. And keep in mind that San Diego, we didn't have the shotgun formation back then. We had Dan Henning as the head coach. He had just come from Washington, and they didn't believe in it, so he didn't believe in it for some reason. So anyway, opening kickoff comes, nothing really happens. I'm running out to the field. We'll get the ball on the 20. Courtney grabs me and says, hey, I'm sorry, but if your hand starts to stink, it's because I just shit my pants. And so before the game even started, I burn a timeout. And I walk over to the sideline, and Henning is just, he's just all over me. What are you doing? And I said, well, this is exactly why we need the shotgun formation. I said, your boy just unloaded in his pants, and I'm not sticking my hand in there all damn game. Till he cleans up, get him out of here. And so the rest of the game, I was getting splattered every time the ball hit me. It was not fun.
But those
are the kind of things a lot of fans don't understand.
Is it like baseball?
What we have to deal with.
The foreign substance on your hand, did it make you throw better like baseball or no?
No, it was sticky and smelly, but I don't know.
So what? We talked about your career with the Bears in the first half of the pod for anybody that's joining us right now. It's Browner and Burt. We're here with Jim McMahon. When you come to San Diego, obviously a California kid, Northern California, you come to Southern California. What were your expectations on arriving in San Diego? Not necessarily but for the Chargers, but for you, for life. Like, San Diego's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful bunch of beautiful people, a lot of good things to do. What was your life expectancy when you signed on to come here to San Diego?
Well, I got to play in San Diego three times in Jack Murphy Stadium, obviously, in the Holiday Bowl with Brigham Young. So I was familiar with the area. I always loved the weather. I knew coming down there, it wouldn't be 30, 40 below zero in December. You know, I wouldn't have to practice in that. And I was just looking forward to a change, you know, just getting back to the good weather in California and, you know, hopefully some good football.
Was it shocking for you? Because it kind of, you know, I mean, I grew up in Philly and then I went to Pitt, and those are big football towns. I was shocked, and my rookie year was the year you got traded here, but I was shocked at how much they didn't really know anybody here as far as football. Like, you leave Chicago and you're like a god there, and you can go anywhere and there's probably 10,000 people at your training camp. You come out here and there's like three people at training camp. You go anywhere in town, they don't know who you are. Was that a big shock for you?
No, it was actually great.
That was going to be my next question. After everything that you had just gone through in Chicago, was it a relief to come here and have no one know who you were?
Yeah, it was quite refreshing. You know, that was still right before, you know, cell phones and everything else. So it was nice to not have anybody just always in your face. And it was a good first impression.
You know, my memory was I held out that whole season, and I signed like the day we were breaking camp. And I signed my contract. I came at night and I was in my dorms. And that's when you're all hazing people still. And I remember I looked out the window. And that's when I locked my door. And you had had a couple of drinks and you had Billy Joe Tolliver all taped up lying in a parking lot doing donuts in your golf cart around his head, like an inch away, probably.
Well, they were taped up, but we did have pillows for them. And it wasn't a golf cart. It was actually my truck.
Oh, I thought it was a golf cart.
I kept spinning around. I go, you guys better lean up. So we were making them do sit-ups as we were coming around their heads. It was kind of fun.
Yeah, that could have went really wrong, though, you know.
Yeah.
In hindsight. So,
like, when you're doing that.
A lot of things I've done could have went really wrong.
When you're doing that kind of stuff back then, nobody cares. It's funny. You could never do anything like that today. When you watch the way that the NFL is covered today and the way that the athletes behave today and the way that that's covered, like what happened recently with Richard Sherman, do you go, I'm glad I played when I did? Or do you think you would have had not an afterlife to a career, because I think you've had a great post-career. But do you think you would have had any different things happen in your career if the coverage had been the same?
I wouldn't have done well in today's social media world. That's for sure.
Yeah, cell phone videos and cameras.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad I played when I did. You know, I really don't understand all this. My son actually does all my social media for me. I couldn't even know how to get on that stuff. If he ever sees anything important, he'll send it on to me. But I really don't care what everybody does all day long, you know?
I agree.
I don't see the fascination with it.
Yeah, I don't think I could have done it with cell phones and videos back in the day. And you remember, I mean, just in the locker room, I mean, we had something in common we were talking about. We both had the unfortunate experience of watching the fridge bend over in front of us in the locker room naked, which is...
That's not pretty. That should not be media.
You had Chicago fridge, man. I had Philadelphia fridge. It was about 100 pounds heavier. It was even worse.
Yeah, when he was a hell of an athlete when he was about 315, 320, but then he started getting a little bigger, and he'd be tired after one or two plays. He was a hell of a lot of fun to be around. Always smiling, always happy.
Yeah, always happy.
He did some amazing things for that size.
Yeah, and I remember being in the defensive meeting room in Philly, and you were in Philly for a little bit, so you know how bad Veterans Stadium was. And we were meeting in films, and Fridge had like this big thing of like chicken wings right in front of him. And a rat jumped up on the table, took one of the wings, and ran out the door right in the middle of films. That's how bad it was there.
Yeah, I remember those big rats and the stench. You know, all our meeting rooms were at the bottom of the vet, and it just stunk for three hours of meeting. It just couldn't wait to get back outside.
Yeah, piss and beer.
Did you travel from franchise to franchise and get this impression that what the hell is going on here? I mean, because obviously the McCaskies run a good franchise. I mean, let me correct myself. You were in it. You were in it. So from Chicago to San Diego, Philadelphia, Minnesota, Arizona, Green Bay, you have all these stops.
You forgot 2 weeks in Cleveland, man.
Well, no one wants to talk about Cleveland ever at any point in time. So you have all these points and times. Did you ever ask yourself, how did they let these people own the team?
Well, I didn't really deal with a whole lot of owners. You know, I had to deal with George Halas when I first got drafted. And then Mike McCaskey, I wasn't all that impressed with him. I don't know if I think I might have met Spanos once when I was there.
He was never around.
The other owners never really got to know any of those. I had my lawyer talk to them. I didn't really want to be talking to the ownership.
I'm referring more to Green Bay.
I mean, I don't know if your question was who was the best organization. And I said this a few weeks ago, from top to bottom, the best organization that I played for was Green Bay.
I was speaking more of conditions, but since you mentioned that, when you see Aaron Rodgers behaving like a child for an organization that has basically literally given him everything he's ever asked for, what did you think of that from a quarterback's perspective?
Well, somebody asked me that the other day, and I don't really know the whole story. I just know he wants to hold out for some reason. I hear that
He wants the general manager fired, and they said they're not doing that.
Well, I don't know about I don't know about that story, but from what I was hearing is that they keep drafting people for defense and nobody to help him out. Is that semi correct? I don't follow it enough to know the exact.
It's a multifaceted issue. But when people say that, oh, they're not drafting offensive players for him. He's got the number one wide receiver in the league. He's got a top five offensive line. He's got an all-pro running back. And the head coach was hired specifically for the offense. So I don't really understand people's impression that he doesn't have enough. Like, what are they watching him do? Like, he's great, yeah. But so is Davante Adams. He's fantastic. He's now rated the number one wide receiver in the league. So what more can you give a guy that has everything?
Yeah, I don't know. That's why I'm glad I'm out. I ain't got to worry about all this.
Hey, man, tell me, because I read a story the other day, and I think I remember when it happened. You was it Lombardi that you choked out at Cleveland?
Yeah, I had some words with that guy.
Did you ever get in trouble for that?
No.
Not at all?
No. If they would have called the cops or anything, they would have had to explain why I was choking them. And why I was choking them is because they did a deal under the table and then they reneged on it. They didn't want to pay. And they still haven't paid. So the hell with them.
How did you find yourself in that situation?
Well, at the end of training camp, Bill Belichick called me, and this is the last year they're going to be there before they're moving to Baltimore, right? So the fans are – everybody's pissed off in the city. They don't like the owner. So Bill calls me, and he says, look, we have to release you because we got a lot of guys hurt. We need roster spots, this and that. And I said, oh, that's cool. And I didn't really want to be in Cleveland. I don't know why my agent sent me there. But he goes, no, I really need you here. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, I can't go into the season with Vinny and then a rookie backup. I need an experienced backup. I said, Bill, what are you telling me? I said, if I'm going to be here, I move my family here. I have to find a hockey team for my sons. You know, there's a lot I got to do. And he says, no, we're going to take care of you. I said, what does that mean? He says, well, we're going to pay you to sit out. So I called my attorney. I said, can I trust this guy? He just said he's going to pay me to sit out. He said, well, you got to take him at his word. So I did. You know, I go find a house to live in. I find a hockey team for my boys. And, the first week goes by. I called in on Friday for my check, and they give me the runaround. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe first week jitters. And so the second week goes by. Call them on Friday again. Give me the runaround again. 7 weeks of runaround I get from these people.
Oh.
You know, I'm doing nothing in Cleveland. I'm working out at the local Gold's gym. You know, I'm not throwing any balls. I'm just, I'm hitting a lot of balls at Firestone. That was kind of fun. But, that's how it all happened. And then finally they signed me back. I think it was week 8. I get the next 3 checks. And then right after that game against the Packers is when I had that confrontation with Lombardi. And then it was it. I was done there. The next day I was up in Green Bay. And we finished out that year. We lost the NFC Championship game that year, but then I stayed one more year. We won the Super Bowl, and I said, that's enough.
So when you come to you get into a conversation like that with Bill Belichick, are you sure the owner's aware?
Oh, yeah, he told me to my face. Yeah, Mr. Modell knows what's going on.
Belichick's the liar. So wait, so who lied? Who do you feel at the end of the day lied to you? Was it Belichick?
Belichick is who made the deal with me.
Okay.
And then Lombardi was a GM, and he didn't keep it. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
And then you choked him out.
I had him by the neck and maybe hit his head against the wall one or two times.
So what would happen?
That was before all the cameras and everything. So that was great.
What would happen today if you saw, like, Aaron Rodgers went to Green Bay and choked out and slammed the dude's head against the wall as general manager? I mean, that's just the difference of today and back then.
Yeah, that probably wouldn't happen today. Like you said, it'll be on camera and they'd have to explain. So that's why I never got in trouble for it. You know, I talk about it all the time. I'm like, who are they going to believe? You know, the guru Belichick or me, the so-called crazy one.
Did you think he would be this good of a coach? Did you, because you were there with him. You saw him in Cleveland where he was terrible, not terrible, but He wasn't what he is today. Did you foresee him being that good?
I wasn't all that impressed. I played against his defenses many times. I didn't think I might have lost maybe one or two. Wherever he was, we played against him and we ended up beating him. So I guess the AFC hasn't been that good for how many years?
So do they have the same? I mean, you know, everybody makes this thing about Belichick works 23 hours a day and he's a workaholic and everybody got to stay. Was it like that in Cleveland or is that a new thing?
Well, he was basically for the defense, so I didn't have to deal with him much.
So now that you are retired, like you've got a new business going, are you the spokesperson for this? Because the names that you mentioned that you're in business with, Ricky Williams, who's famous, not famous for pot smoking, he was an amazing football player, great at Texas, great in the NFL. Do you find yourself in the second half of your career trying to recapture the same energy as a player, or do you feel like the second half of your career is going in a completely different direction?
Oh no, this is a lot easier than getting the crap beat out of you every Sunday. But no, just going into business with these other, you know, fellow alumni from the NFL, I think it's going to be great, not just for us, but for advocacy for marijuana. I mean, it's a medicinal herb. It's not a drug. We've been lied to for over 100 years about it. People are finally starting to realize that, hey, you know, you got to get off these pills that they keep shoving down your throat, you know, because those things are addictive. Those things do kill people. Cannabis has never killed anybody. So, you know, we're supposed to be using this plant. Everybody in the world has a system for this plant, the endocannabinoid system. And that's why it's there. You know, we need this plant. That's why it stays in your body for so long, because we've been deprived of it. And your body just wants, it's craving, it wants to hold on to it. And so I'm glad it's finally, I think the NFL is changing their rules, letting these guys, at least the guys that live in states that it's legal. I mean, how can you not let them use it? It's their bodies. Why should they not be able to put what they want into their bodies?
I've said this, and I will repeat this to whomever. The white power structure in the NFL is why weed is still illegal amongst their guidelines and rules. Because what they actually give you is far more harmful to your physical and your mental health than giving a guy a joint and saying, hey, all right, take this and leave these pills alone. And if you still have aches and pains, we come talk and then we'll work it out from there. But the first step should just be to give a guy a joint. One, they're familiar with it because most guys smoke before they get to the NFL. And two, it's an easier thing for guys to get access to because it's readily available everywhere.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, people always, you know, they have this misconception that it's a gateway drug. No, it's actually an exit drug. You know, you can get off a lot of bullshit if you just use it, the natural, you know, what I call it, you know, God's miracle plant for us. I mean, it was put on this earth for us to use it to heal ourselves. You know, that's why it's so pungent. You know, back in the day, people had to find it so they could heal themselves. And, you know, they understood it way back then, and so did our government. You know, they're just too tied into big pharma to care about mm-hmm. something that's actually good for you.
Hey, Jim, you had your grand opening, and you're building like a little kind of cool super center up there in Ramona. What made you guys pick Ramona?
It's a great question.
Well, Kyle Turley is really the backbone of this, you know, the startup of this company. And he's been really researching. He had a dispensary of his own a while back. And, you know, he studies this plant. I mean, he studies all the different strains, and he's really been wanting to expand on his business. And this is where all these ideas are coming from. And we're just happy to be part of his group. And you know, he's got a tremendous passion for the plant. And, you know, you just sit down and talk to him for a little bit, you'll understand that. And it saved his life and a lot of other lives that, you know, these guys have really been suffering. You know, a lot of our teammates, our ex-teammates have killed themselves, and we want to get that to stop.
Well, I hope that the advocacy for this from such large names like yourself, like Ricky Williams, like Cal Turley, like big-name guys come out and defend this. I think Calvin Johnson has spoke about this as well. I think there's a lot of guys who are in the NFL right now who would absolutely be in favor of the NFL just – stop testing for it. You don't have to, because if you don't test for it, you don't know who's taking it. So just take that test. You can continue to test for all these other things, but stop testing for that. And I think the NFL would be a much better place, for a much healthier place for a lot of these guys. Because you don't have any CTE issues yet, do you?
I've got a lot of those.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I have to go back to New York every 3 months to get an adjustment. I have a spinal fluid problem it backs up, and I've got to get some way to get it released. And, you know, the only other option for me would be a brain surgery and have a shunt put in, and I don't want to have to deal with that. At least now I know what's wrong. And so when I start having my issues, I get on the phone, call my doc, say, hey, I'll see you in a couple of days, and then make a flight. And I'd rather do that than have to go through another surgery that I don't think I need.
That's the crazy part with the NFL. You remember it, Jim. It's like you could get a handful of Vicodin and Percocet all you wanted from the training room, but you can't smoke weed. It's like, it was such a hypocritical thing. It was just crazy to me all the time. And it's even worse now.
Well, hopefully it's from what I hear, it's turning around. I mean, they got to acknowledge it at some point. But then again, you know, most, you know, Goodell, all these people, they come from the big tobacco. You know, they represent a big tobacco. How long did they lie to the public? And yeah. We're still getting over the stigma. You know, there shouldn't be a stigma after all these years. But
I know you got a bowl right there. Why don't you light one up and get over stigma right now on camera?
All right.
Browner's mouth's watering right now. Let me get my Cheetos.
Let Jim do his thing, and we'll catch him on camera. Thanks for being a part of our show. I'm John Browner. That's Jim McMahon. And that's Bert Grossman. What a conversation. Till next time, everybody. Peace.
Later,
guys.
Thank
you, Jim.
You're welcome. Good to see you.
Too.